Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, what's up? Let's ride. Nikias. First things first, hi, hope you're doing well. Want to make sure I get this intro right for you. Okay. Dude, I got here in the nick of time. But it's time to hoop it up.
It is time to hoop it up indeed. We got a fun one for you. Last pod before post All-Star break games officially begin. So that's going to be fun. Ready to dig into what the second half is going to look like. Got some questions. Y'all sent in some tremendous stuff, either through email or on Twitter. So we appreciate y'all for participating. Going to get to your questions. We have some thoughts. I have a very long list of players that I'm excited to watch post All-Star break. Like, that's going to be one of our prompts. And I did the Nikias thing and went overboard. So we'll get to that towards the back end of the pod. But first, we will start with some news items, some news that will be pleasing to Wolves fans and also to Steve. The Wolves and Mike Conley agreeing to a 2-year extension worth $21 million. Conley this year averaging 10.6 points per game, 45% on twos, 44% from three, 92% from the line, over 6 assists per game, only 1.1 turnovers, doing a great job of taking care of the ball, making sound decisions as Mike Conley does. And on the year per clean the glass, which filters out garbage time, a plus 10 net rating, 116.9 offensive rating, and an absurd 106.9 defensive rating. And over 2,900 possessions with Mike Conley on the floor. Steve, how are we feeling about the Conley extension?
Well, I'm trying to warm back up with the All-Stars after the intro. I'm trying to get back going. one of the great guys of all time. Good to see him re-sign with Minnesota. Good to see Minnesota not only get the proof of concept for this year, but you take what you've built and you've got Mike, Anthony Edwards, Kat, Rudy, Nas, McDaniels all locked in for at least the next 2 years. That's a plus. We know what we have. We can build on it and see how far we can take it. I was a little surprised at the price, but salute to Mike for getting that no trade clause. Mm-hmm. AKA, hey man, I'm not just moving anywhere, big dog. So you're going to tell me.
It goes through me.
Yeah, you could, but you could just feel the shift for Minnesota when they acquired Mike Conley last year. And obviously the chemistry with Rudy Gobert was something that jumped out immediately. But, you know, when you watch Minnesota, you have to see how important Mike is to balancing out the Wolves offense, getting guys to buy in. The way that he can make plays, steady the ship, but can be used on ball and off ball. He can be a guy who's in the movement sets. It can give Anthony Edwards and Kat room to explore, but also room to grow. We don't have to carry every single part of this mantle. We can kind of enhance and develop our playmaking in a more natural way. It's not all on them to generate everything. Defensively, always in the right spot, whether he's on the ball, great screen navigation, can throw some switches in, great help defense. I don't think he gets enough credit for the work he's done on that end with Minnesota's defense. But just a great guy for these guys to be able to lean on at this part of the journey as they really search for this, you know, championship mentality. And that's been one of my favorite parts of this season has been the quotes that have come out of Minnesota this year. Every time it looks like, hey, what's going on in Minnesota? They got a quote saying, hey, we want to win a championship. This is our mindset, our purpose, explaining how we want to do it, how we have to play together offensively, how we have to get back to what we do defensively. I think he plays a big part in that. And it's funny, his two best shooting years from three have come in Minnesota. 44% this year, 6.4 assists. Sit me down a quick rabbit hole, Nikias.
Ah, we got the early Steve rabbit hole.
So there are 9 players this season averaging 6 or more assists and shooting 40% from three. Draymond Green doesn't technically qualify because of the games, but he has it. D'Angelo Russell, Jamal Murray, Jalen Brunson, Tyus Jones, Domantas Sabonis, James Harden, Tyrese Halliburton, and Mike Conley. Only one of those players averages 6 or more assists while shooting 44% from three. Do you know who it is?
I'm going to guess that's Mike Conley.
It's Mike Conley. Put some respect on his name.
Hey, a quick question for you. Is Conley the best defender of that group? You said Draymond doesn't count. So, like, he would obviously be the answer here. But
yeah, I'd say that with my chest.
Yeah, that's that's an impressive company to be in, first and foremost. And then once you factor in the defense and what he's doing at this stage of his career, like, it's super impressive. But I echo all your sentiments. It's been fun watching him flow on and off the ball on both ends of the floor this year. I think that's been the biggest thing for me that's popped. When he needs to assume more on-ball usage, run some ball screens with Rudy, or just get guys in the spots, he'll do that. Otherwise, he's chilling. He's comfortable chilling off the ball and just knocking down spot-up shots. He's done that at a high level. Defensively, you mentioned the screen navigation. The help defense, I think it's a bit quieter because you notice, like, Anthony Edwards roaming the passing lanes or Jaden McDaniels closing in gaps or what Rudy Gobert does as a weak side guy at the rim, or as you've noted, as we've noted throughout the season, how much better he's gotten at those help and recover sequences when he is spaced. You kind of miss Mike Conley at the nail, getting back out to his guy, sliding in front of a ball handler, cutting off a drive. Like, that doesn't show up in a, you know, it doesn't show up as anything unless you're going like 8th spectrum or whatever. But he's been able to do some of those quieter things that help Minnesota not only build the best defense in the league, one that has been borderline historically good this season. And so it's nice. And the last thing I'll say, I'm also very surprised at that price point. Like, I figured he could have gotten a lot more than that. I don't think he's going to be clamoring for a max, but was that 10 and a half a year? Like, that feels like that's a little bit lower than I think what the mid-level exception is projected to be next season. That's really surprising. He must be very comfortable there to the no trade clause point. He has to be comfortable there. It's like, if I'm moving, I am choosing where I'm going to a degree. So very friendly for him. And then with the broader picture of Minnesota, being able to lock him into that deal, maybe that eases a little bit of your concerns about what the team's going to look like next year, since they have the big reckoning coming in terms of their tax bill. They don't literally have to blow things up or make a big move they don't want to. If you got the owners and they got the money, they can pay, they can foot that bill. But if you do have concerns about what that's going to look like and what the championship possibilities actually are with this group, and we'll find out more once we get to the postseason. Having Conley locked in at that makes it a lot easier to say, okay, at least we are going to have Ant, we are going to have Rudy, we're going to have Cat, we're going to have at least four of these five or five of these six and not have to worry about it to that degree. So props to Mike Conley, having a heck of a season. And that is a good bit of business for both sides, I believe. We talked on Thursday about the Nets. The news kind of broke as we were gathering pod thoughts and stuff that the Nets fired Jock Vaughn. They have indeed promoted assistant Kevin Ollie to interim head coach. Steve, do you have any quick thoughts on that one? We're recording early on a Thursday afternoon. Brooklyn's first game with Kevin Ollie will be later tonight, so we don't have instant reaction for the first game. But any early thoughts on Ollie being promoted?
EGBs, baby.
We got the podcast.
Ollie was, Kevin Ollie, he was linked to a few jobs, whispers, so this would be some quality experience for him. I think just over the last few days, listening to the quotes from Sean Marks about the level of compete and effort plays, loose balls, contested shots, I would absolutely expect there to be a particular style of basketball that Sean Marks wants to see from this team, and it will be on Kevin Ollie to deliver it. So it's more just take a look and see how they come out. What are they running? What's the pace look like? What's the tempo look like? What's the movement look like? And then how hard are they working on the defensive end? What schemes do they want to do? This feels like a stretch where you're trying to reestablish who you are and get this style of play. You know, from personal experience, it's like, hey, y'all, just play fast. Just play fast, play hard. And I was like, all right, cool. We'll do that. then you look up the next year and it's like, oh, that's just what they do now. Cool.
All right, then.
But yeah, I'd expect high effort, high pace. Kevin Ollie said he wants hunters. If you don't hunt, you will not be hooping. So that's very neat. I do have a respectfully messy free throw for you, though.
Okay.
So Kevin Ollie said he has 17 EGBs, energy-generating behaviors. Will the Nets display all 17 of those, or will they get more wins than EGBs?
Ooh. So more than 17 wins post All-Star break?
Yeah.
And they have how many games left in the season?
I want to say 28. There's a computer right in front of my face. I could just look this up and do math.
I got the standings up. They are 21 and 33, so that is what? 54 games. They got 28 left. 17 and 11 to close things out. That feels They already have 30 home games. No, I don't. I'm going to vote with the EGBs.
Okay. Perfect. Cool. That's all I have.
Okay. Figure out, get your thoughts on that one. Some other transaction news. The Warriors converting Lester Quiñones to a standard contract, averaging a shade under 5 points per game in 13 minutes off the bench for Golden State this year. More specifically, shooting nearly 40% from three. He's in to do one thing. He gets that job done. Also, just plays with an energy that I do like. So, not going to go super deep on Lester Quiñones. We got a lot of players to talk about. But quick salute to him. Not a transaction yet, but Otto Porter Jr., who was traded from Toronto to Utah, has not played a game for Utah yet. He remains away from the team. Some reporting from Tony Jones of The Athletic saying that Otto Porter Jr. may agree to a buyout. He has to, if that buyout does happen, he has to be signed to his new team by March 1st to be playoff eligible. So we'll be keeping tabs on that over the next week or so. We'll see if a buyout does come to fruition. But any early thoughts on potential suitors for Otto Porter Jr. if he does get a buyout with Utah?
All right. I have none.
Okay. Got the head shake from Steve. All right. Very cool. I think the quick one to point to would be Golden State, just because that was, you know, we're 2 years removed from that being his healthiest campaign, shooting well, filling gaps for Golden State on both ends, winning a title there. So like that would feel like a pretty natural spot. But I guess with the emergence of Jonathan Kuminga, Draymond Green playing more five, I guess we'll see like what the playing time will look like there. But like in terms of the fit, that would feel like an easy one. I think it'd just be like a rock. How would you feel about the Clippers? Like, I don't know if they can't, like, they would have to find, they have to waive someone to clear a spot, I would imagine, which I don't know how hazy that could get. But if you got questions about, hey, what do some of the small ball lineups look like? He does give them a little bit more size, and you got the shooting element there.
When would he play? Like, PJ Tucker already doesn't play.
That's true.
That's why I shook my head. Mm-hmm. Where can he go to play right now? Mm-hmm. Not that he can't help, but right now, where would he go? Like Phoenix?
I think Phoenix does have one roster spot remaining. If you want even more front court options for some of the smaller lineups, that would certainly make some sense. Phoenix would make some sense. I would have to see what their roster spot situation is right now, but how would you feel about Cleveland?
I like the idea. Mm-hmm. But when would he play?
Well, I guess we will. It's going to be funny. We're going to finish recording this pod, and there's going to get like a Shams tweet. He signed with the Knicks. They were going to come on the pod on Monday. Hey, is he going to play? So we will see what happens with Otto Porter Jr. Just want to get some thoughts there. Now, as we enter the post All-Star break stretch, this is going to be the most important stretch of the season, naturally. We solicited some questions from you dunkers, so thank you for sending them in, both on Twitter and through the email, which is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. So if you ever have basketball thoughts in general, send those to us. We will get to them. But before we dig into the specific what is my team going to do portion of the post All-Star break program, we got a question from Parker, a Dunkerspot watch party room regular. Who says, hey, Steve and Nikias, love the podcast and all the great work that you guys do. I had a question about how players' usage has evolved over the years. I guess the question would be, has positionless basketball made us overtask certain stars past what their usage should be? I think of guys like Karl-Anthony Towns and Jason Tatum, who are really tall and good at multiple things offensively, but usually face criticism when at times their play suffers, particularly in a playoff context. I was wondering how much of this is them being overtasked by having to wear maybe one or two too many hats based off of what their skill set is, and if we should reevaluate just how many things we are asking a guy to do just because they happen to be good at them, and if it might be better to construct teams around them that allow them to play a specialized role similar to what they would have done in previous eras of the league.
Let's talk about it.
Let's chop it up.
Because I love this question. Great question, Parker. They was cooking on that one, Nikias. I will go first because I have thoughts and opinions and understanding. I want to have a conversation about this, and this might end up being longer than it needs to be, but you know what you signed up for.
It's the Dunkers only, baby.
I think some of it gets tied to context and how that can shift things. When you talk about Jason Tatum in particular, The talent was always there with Jason Tatum. We can agree on that, right? Mm-hmm. The team shifted to place him in a higher role so that talent could shine. With that comes an increase in usage, or at least what we feel is an increase in usage or an increase of importance, or, you know, they need him to do these specific things in order for this team to have success, as opposed to he's pretty good. Can he do this? I think it just shifts a little bit. That can be seen as being overtasked, but that increased usage is generally going to give that talent the possibility to improve and mold and grow. So without that shift in usage or importance, do we see this version of Jason Tatum? Do we get this much out of him versus where he was before? And I think that's where it gets tricky, because you see a talent, you see the potential of a talent, you see the production of a talent, you know what that could mean for your team. And at some point, you have to make the move to say, yep, this is it. Let's go there. So with me, with Jason Tatum, the real shift was when the scoring led to defenses having to treat him differently. And then the playmaking got to a level where he can make defenses pay. And the roster was improved around to where we have a blend of scoring, playmaking, and we can make you pay with other people. And now, yep, Jason Tatum's scoring. Jason Tatum's making plays, forcing two on the ball. Marcus Smart's initiating offense. Kickouts are going to Jason Tatum. Boy, that's a tough blend. I thought that was a key shift for Tatum in Boston. So now you have an understanding of what he can do in totality. You have an understanding of what you can do to enhance that around him. And so you can reshape and retool the roster around him so he doesn't become overtasked to a degree. Like, in theory, if you're looking at the Celtics, you have Derek White, you have Jrue Holiday, you have Jaylen Brown around him to help in those moments. You have Porzingis, who could space and roll. You have Horford, who could space. You have things that enhance what he's already done, mm-hmm, to the point where it doesn't feel like he's having the type of season that he's having if you look at the numbers. But mm-hmm, the impact says something different. When he drives, feels different. When he's making plays of pick and roll, it feels different. When he's kicking out and two on the ball, it feels different. But you view him in a certain lens. So it's like he has to do so much. Or he's so good, they lean on that. So in those fourth quarter moments where, hey, we want to make sure we get him the ball, we want to make sure we attack a matchup, now you start to feel, oh, he has to do a lot. When in reality, this is our belief in our guy. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then with Cat, did you have any Tatum thoughts before I keep going?
I have like a general thought. I'm curious to hear your Cat thoughts. So I'll let you finish that out first.
All right. With Cat, I go back to context, because you look back, 2021 usage was at 28.6, then 27.2, then 25, and it's 26.9 right now as we speak. My thing becomes, what's the balance that you want for him? But all of his context changed during this time span. When he really started to pop in Minnesota, it was at what position, guys?
It was at the five.
It was at the five. And now you saw, oh, he can do all of this. He has the ability to space. He has the ability to pop and roll, the ability to drive past bigs, closing out. You can get it to him at the elbow, and he can get those drives there. He can score in the post. He can pass out of that. That really stood out. Teams responded with, well, here's some switches. You go back to the Grizzlies. Here's some fronts. Here's some switches. Go ahead and do it. We're going to take this off the table a little bit. And now you transition to, here comes Rudy Gobert. Who plays what position, guys?
The five.
So now Cat and that skill set is at what position, guys?
The four.
Being defended by the people.
Other four.
that they were using to try and take his skill set away at the five. And some of those things that were a clear positive and a clear plus came question marks to a degree. And he had to work through it. And you see this year, he's reestablished some of that in a different way to where, yep, I can still shoot. Yep, I can still play minutes at the five and punish you there. But at the four, I can space. I can come off screens. I can get handoffs. I can run pick and roll with Rudy. When I'm off ball, I can cut from the wing. I can time that up. I have a clear path as far as being more decisive when I get catches. I can catch it in better spots against some of these other defenders and drive that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we understand just how good Cat could have been if they had stuck with him at the five. Do we get this version of Cat if they don't make that trade? Mm. Is he just Cat at the five and teams are switching? So I think there's a relationship between the context of a team and the usage of a player. Because now Cat may be overtasked to a degree, but at the same time, he has Anthony Edwards. He stepped up defensively and done his job. So they can afford some of the nights where Cat doesn't have it going in a way they couldn't before. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was going to say, like, one, I really do like the question. And, like, if there is a positive way to struggle with the question, I think that's how it would start with this one. Because my mind just kind of went all over the place. And it was interesting that Parker brought up Jason Tatum and Karl Anthony Towns. Because as I went through the question, the first name that I thought about with this was Devin Booker. And I thought about the early Phoenix days to where he was quite literally overtasked and the team still wasn't good. And he got all of those primary reps, You looked at some of the point guards that he played with. You know, we're not going to get respectfully messy on the pod, but he kind of had to take on a lot of those on-ball decisions in addition to what he brought as a scorer. Because you think about what Devin Booker was projected to be coming out of college, it's very much this dude can shoot the leather off of it. He's going to be really good off ball. He has some on ball juice. We'll see. And him immediately shifting to you are our creator was not something that I anticipated, which one, that could just be banked in because I'm not super draft dude. But even like reading smarter people than I with draft stuff, like that didn't seem to be what people thought was going to be that early. But it's interesting, like watching that progression. And all the jokes that he had to endure. But watching that progression into, hey, here's Ricky Rubio. It's like, oh, this feels a lot easier for Devin Booker now. He can shift back to some of the off-ball stuff, but also he can punish you in a way with the ball in his hands. He's gotten so good at the scoring portion, and he's grown as a playmaker to where you can trap him. That was something that he had to work through and something that he still improved against. But, you know, to your earlier point about Jason Tatum, the fact that he got to the level to where defense thought about putting two on the ball consistently, that was a growth area. Out goes Ricky Rubio. Here comes Chris Paul. Here's a finals appearance. But you still see Devin Booker. I can take on more of this on-ball usage if necessary. Chris is here, so I don't have to do all these things. I can find this blend now. And so, like, we've had conversations before about development with, like, younger prospects and stars and stuff like that. And like how much you can put on their shoulders and how you can accelerate the curve or like what are the downsides to doing that. And so I've always thought about this concept within the development lens. I haven't thought about it to, you know, to Parker's point about could this player be overtasked and how does that affect our analysis? And so I love everything you said about Jason Tatum in particular with the context changing around him. He had the scoring growth, similar playmaking growth to a Devin Booker. They add all this talent to where Jason Tatum may still be like their best initiator at the end of the day, but the fact that you can say Derek White runs some stuff so Tatum doesn't have to, Drew Holiday runs some stuff so Tatum doesn't have to, we will now throw it into the mid post for Kristaps if they do decide to switch or whatever, so we can take some pressure off. Here's Al Horford. Let's run a whole bunch of delay stuff so Jason Tatum can get off the ball a little bit. The fact that they made a conscious decision to add that kind of talent, and not just that kind of talent, but to add players that could fill those roles temporarily. So Tatum doesn't have to do it. Because as he's growing as a playmaker, like, would you say Tatum is a top five passer at his position? Like, he's probably on the cuffs there, right? Somewhere in that range?
Yeah.
We could also agree that he's not a LeBron-level passer or creator or a Luka-level. Like, I think that part's fair. And so you don't want Tatum running 50 ball screens a game. It's helpful that you add these other guards and you can able to kind of parse through some of the playmaking responsibilities to those guys. So Tatum doesn't have to do it. And so like, I'm trying to like, to the heart of the question, I don't know how much of the overtask portion comes into play for me. Like that's something I'm working through in real time. Like it's a really interesting it's a really interesting concept.
Well, I think the positionless basketball part of it is where it's like, I think it's because guys can just do more in different spots and they can be used in different ways. And there's more pace, more tempo, more possessions. So it kind of has a different feel to it than, you know what I mean? What about the post-up player back in the day? Were they overtasked? You're the person that has to score in the post for us. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you scoring in the post for us?
Yeah, like I guess to that point, like in a literal sense, yes, because if you're trying to win or you're trying to build out a successful offense, you need someone that can draw two in some capacity. And so like, depending on what your team is, that guy or that position, you know, is not always going to be back to basket center. It may be Cat, who's more of a pick and pop guy. It may be Tatum, who's big wing creator. So, like, to that portion of it, like it's yes, because different guys are just able to do that, to your point. I don't know if that's inherently a detriment. It does put pressure on those teams, like Phoenix has been able to build things out around Devin Booker, how Boston has been able to build things out around Jason Tatum. You still have to have a recognition of this guy has gotten much better at this than even we anticipated, but it would be more helpful if he doesn't have to be the be-all, end-all. We still need to have other guys that can take some of this stuff off his plate, if that makes sense.
It's a tricky balance, man. Like, I don't know if you find out some of these things about these players without handing over some of that hierarchy, some of that usage, some of forcing it to be overtasked. Like, I look at Bam Adebayo. How long has he been overtasked?
Yes.
How much has he improved?
Also, yes.
Do you get this version of Bam Adebayo without that push towards this?
You do not.
I'm not sure. Like, I don't think you do. But you find out how good Bam is, and now you can look and see, okay, we need this around it to maximize it. And so if you get player X, big whale, now it's like, oh, they have this, this, and that. Or you get players that can enhance what he does already. Oh, okay. If teams are going to double Bam, we can make them pay. You can kind of just build off what you've seen. It can flip quickly. Let's look at Tyrese Maxey, right? He's probably under test to a degree for a little bit, but that served him well. And he produced to a point where they believed him and he was what, properly tasked. And right now during the stretch, he's probably going to be overtasked. All that's going to be good for him and the Sixers, because now you're going to find out exactly how far Maxey as a concept can take you, what you need around Maxey and Embiid, and you can build and shape moving forward. It's a good positive step for him. I think about Fred VanVleet, right? Think about Fred in Toronto before they got Jakob Poeltl, Fred in Toronto after they got Jakob Poeltl, just these last couple of years, and then Fred in Houston. What are the differences?
Well, when you have a big that can screen, life is a little bit easier for Fred VanVleet. And when you do not have a big that can screen, life is a lot more difficult for Fred VanVleet and thus the rest of the Toronto offense.
That's a factor. Then you go to Houston and, hey, we need what you do. But, hey, we need what you do. And we play a little slower. So, yeah. Big dog, can you, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I look at Cade Cunningham. Overtask. These reps are going to help. You're going to find out a lot. Look at Mikal Bridges. That's a question I wanted to ask. Where's he falling on this for you? Because it's been a wild, wild, very quick flip with Mikal Bridges from he can't even do all that to, oh, he can do all that to see, I told you he can't do all that. And I don't understand how that works.
To Mikal be like, hey, can I do more of that, please? Allegedly, reportedly.
He's a bucket getter. I remember that playoff series. Made enough baskets to where Joel Embiid was like, all right, man, no more for you.
No more of that.
No more of this. The problem is most defenses are like, you know what? I look around this context. Go ahead and shoot, bud.
Oh.
You have to make a lot of these for me to change from drop or switch. And now guess what? You're in a box. And now you have to build around that. You have to figure out, how do we enhance that? How do we move this? How do we get something that's going to shift the defense and make them do something different? Does that speak to McCall can't do X, Y, Z? To some, it might. To me, it just says, hey, I think we need more around that.
So it can pop.
So that can have more of an impact. And teams can think about that more. Like, I look at the CJ Zion Ingram trio and how that's progressed. Is that an example of keeping everyone in their right roles? Are you holding anyone back? Are you having to work to find ways to make sure everyone's comfortable? It gets tricky. Mm-hmm. It gets tricky. But that's it's a different league. Like, would you say Domantas Sabonis is over test?
I don't know if I would tell him that. I've seen those drives and post-ups. But one could make the argument that, you know, like, and even to that point, like, that's why it's been fun watching, oh, cool, Keegan's getting a few more handoffs. This is fun. Keegan's driving a little bit more. That's fun. If you can trust Keegan to do a little bit more to creation stuff, okay, maybe, you know, De'Aaron goes from, I'm just making up this number at this point. Like, all right, De'Aaron goes from 35 pick and rolls a game to 32 now. That's neat. Okay, some of these handoffs for Domantas Sabonis, okay, we don't have to run 14 of these with Kevin Huerter. We can drop this to 11. Keegan can do a little bit more. We can sprinkle this out. We can take some pressure off of some of these guys. Because now more guys, we feel comfortable doing things with the ball in their hands. I like this one. I guess to the playoff criticism point, like, I feel like this is something that we already try to bank in with our analysis. Especially when other guys are just hurt. It's like, okay, well, yeah, like, these numbers probably don't look as great as you would want them to. Like, their context has changed. I think in general, this is why we hammer home how important context is. Both, like, just as a general, hey, don't just say this, like, explain what else is happening. But, like, with roster building and lineup construction and player roles within lineups and all the good stuff, like, all of that matters. And so, like, at bare minimum, like, I think it's worth exploring that more, which is, I'm glad this question came in. Like, it really made me think.
No, it's a great question. But again, like, I want to remind folks, like, on the other side of that fence is a whole group of people whose job it is to A, beat you, and B, make life very, very difficult on you. Hey, you're very good. We are throwing all of our weight towards making sure you're not that good. And if you are that good, it takes 18 more shots than it normally would. Or you can go ahead and be that good. We're going to make sure these guys aren't good. So now you go ahead and cook, buddy. Mm-hmm. No one else is cooking. So now, what? Is that your fault? Were you overtasked? Or did we just beat you? Gotta remember that part of it. I feel like that gets lost in the debates of, oh, they fell short. Dog, I spent the last 2 weeks watching every single possession you have. I'll say it again. I watched every Chris Paul pick and roll when he was with the Clippers and immediately realized the only thing that matters is, can we guard this action for 4 minutes in the fourth quarter? There's your playoff overtask, your criticism. But this is my job to make you, like, cry. I want to send you home.
Well, we can't use that as the pod title. Wow, why do we only have 8 downloads this week? That's crazy. But I like this one. I really like this one. Appreciate you, Parker. Oh, also, just quick sign off here. I didn't add this to the doc. Parker did sign off with Dave Yeager Truther. I was sure that you would.
Shout out DJ.
There we go. All right, let's get into some of these post All-Star break questions that y'all sent in. This one going to come from Austin, who says, first, I think the Rockets are a completely different team this year. Ime has done a great job, and the vets like Fred, Dylan Brooks, and Jeff Green have helped the maturation of this team. But my question is, who do you see out of the young guards and wings etching out more of a role for themselves in the future? And what areas are you looking for them to improve on for the rest of the season? I am leaving Şengün out of the conversation because I feel he is a part of the core moving forward, with him being the hub for the offense. Jalen Green has had his moments of improvement, but also gets benched in closing lineups. Amen Thompson and Cam Whitmore, before his injury, had a strong run of games leading into the break. Jabari Smith Jr. has taken a huge step forward. And Tari Eason, when healthy, has shown that he is a good defender and can knock down an open shot. So, Steve, What are some notes that you have on some of these young guys for the Houston Rockets?
But you're gonna be mad at me. All of them just laid out the case why Rockets fans should be a whole lot happier with their team than they seem to be. I don't understand the issue. Your team is better. You play defense. You play a little slower on offense. Jabari Smith Jr. has gotten a lot better. You should believe in all these guys. This should be a positive for you. We're moving in the right direction compared to last year. You can't tell me the development of Cam Whitmore shouldn't be a plus. You can't tell me what Tari Eason has brought shouldn't be a plus. We can't just take Jalen Green and say, oh, well, he's bad now, so bye. You should be encouraged by what you've seen from this team and now figure out, how do we make this work? How do we get the most out of these guys? This is part of growing pains, man. It's part of the process. It's a question we've asked. I've sat on this very podcast. I've asked about it with OKC, with Houston. How are you going to get all of these guys going at the same time? It's a very difficult process to try and get these guys enhanced all at the same time. Mm-hmm. Hey, you like some of the passing from Thompson? Some of the playmaking? You like that, right? Guess what that means?
He has the ball and these other guys do not.
He has the ball and then some of those guys don't. You like Cam Whitmore's mindset offensively, the aggression, the purpose, the microwave, crashing the glass. We like that, right?
Most of the time, yeah.
Hey, guess what that means?
These other guys don't have
it. Hey, you like when Jalen Green pops and ends up with a triple-double and, oh, the drives are there and, oh, he actually made some shots? Hey, guess what that means?
The other guys don't have it.
You like Alperen Şengün as a hub. Mm-hmm. Guess what sometimes Alperen Şengün as a hub means?
Some of these guards ain't running pick and roll.
Yeah.
You ready to watch post up, buddy?
Yeah, here's this sequence of him just at the elbow, punishing Jaren Jackson Jr. No disrespect, but guess what happened? He caught the ball and went to work. That's part of it. So now it's, how do we mold this talent and figure out what's the best work for us offensively? I feel like they've turned the volume down on the tempo to make sure they get a quality shot. Mm-hmm. That helps you to kind of control tempo to a degree, but at the same time, does it help you overall? Do you miss out some of the transition stuff? Do you miss out flowing into some stuff? Their second most important player is Fred VanVleet. Why is Fred VanVleet their second most important player, Nikias?
Yeah, takes on some of those on-ball decisions.
Yes.
They need the shooting. They need the playmaking.
And if he's taking on some of those on-ball decisions and he's going to open things up, guess what? You got to be able to play off that. Jalen Green's got to figure out how to make that adjustment. He's got to find some comfort within what they're doing. Yeah, they're playing a little bit slower. Yeah, he's off-ball a little bit more. You got to understand where your gaps are. Or are you just space to space? Are you ready to shoot when the ball comes to you? Or are you thinking it's my time to shoot? Mm-hmm. I think it's been an adjustment year for him when the expectation is linear progress. And I understand the frustration. This is not me yelling at that part. Comes with it, though. You got to look at the whole piece of the pie. So for me with Houston, it's just, okay, what are the lineups going to be? What do we enhance from these guys? How do we build these groups together so it works in tandem with each other? I don't think it has to be copy-paste OKC. But you know what OKC did? Hey, y'all can do this, this, and that. Go out there and do this, this, and that. Mm-hmm. And it works in harmony. That's going to be part of the process for Houston, to where they understand the identity of their entire team. But this is a year of, we have to get better at X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. That for me is kind of what's in my brain.
I got you. Like, I think, just to quickly touch on the Jalen Green portion of the program, like, this has very much been a big adjustment year for him. He's been off the ball more. They are playing slower. He's had to, I think, you know, part of the accountability portion. Like, I think he has played harder defensively than he ever has. And I think he should be at least somewhat commended for that portion of the program. Like, we can quibble into, like, how good the defense has been this year. But from an effort standpoint, like, that's ratcheted up a lot from last year, in my opinion. Rocket fans can correct me on that part, but it's felt better in my viewings. They sure will. But it's felt better in my viewing just from the effort portion. So, like, he's had to adjust. I think the frustration with the results not being there is obvious. And I think what adds more frustration, adds more pressure to the program for Jalen in particular, is that this also just feels like the worst possible year for him to have an adjustment year. Because it's almost payment time or restricted free agency time. And so I think for Rocket fans, it's okay. We have all these young dudes, and there is something good to say about all of them. More good things to say about some than others, but there are good things to say about all these young dudes that we're trying to figure out. Okay, who exactly is going to be the core for the next, like, legitimately good Rockets team? We got all these dudes. Some of them have some positional overlap. And it's almost big money time for our top five pick. And for stretches of the season, he has looked worse than the other young guys who we ain't got to pay for another 2 years, 3 years. Like, as a fan, like, that has to be frustrating to try to sort through. And I think for Rockets brass in general, I'm sure they're like, okay, we have all the context here. However, we got to pay this dude soon. Also, we just got Ime in here who has helped us. And depending on how Ime feels about this dude and the money we just gave him, if this turns into Ime or Jalen, when we also have all these other dudes, this might get hazy. So I, like, that portion is where, like, my brows at least raised. But, like, I'm with you, though. I do think, in general, there should be at least a little bit of smoke taken off of Jalen. Like, he's had to shift a lot. And so, like, there is a level of patience that I think that should be had. But I do understand the other pressures that's coming with that. As far as, like, what I would like to see these guys showcase the rest of the year, carve out a role, et cetera. Like, I think with Jalen in particular, like, the off-ball comfort is kind of like the broad strokes, but he has to be able to knock down shots. Like, that's very simplistic analysis, and I apologize. But he's at a career low 30.7% from three. If he's going to be off-ball as much as he is, he's going to have to be able to punish that with the shot and with the drives. And too often this season, even in the good Jalen games, it feels like it's almost solely been, oh, he's making quicker decisions with the drive. Inherently a good thing, but, like, he has to be able to be both. Especially if you don't trust the passing and the decision-making enough to give him a bunch of on-ball reads. And with the addition of Fred VanVleet, he's taking on that on-ball usage. You already mentioned what our man does with the ball in his hands. More of the offense is being ran through Şengün, as it should be. I don't know how many, you know, how much you can raise the volume of, you know, the on-ball growing pains. Like, he has to be able to build that out in the package. So, like, if the shooting comes along, closeouts are harder, drive decisions become a little bit easier to make, passing reads open up from there, I think that's going to be the avenue for him to nail that portion of it. Because if he's able to excel as closeout attacker, and that's not all he is, but if he's able to nail that portion of it with that athleticism, like, he is getting to the line a good bit still, like, that's going to be the quickest way to being a positive value add, I think, for him offensively. And then while we're on the jumper, like, I'm in Thompson, like, that's just going to have to come along. He's been fun as a driver. I have loved the passing flashes for him. Defensively, I think he's going to be very good, keeping an eye on the fouls, but that's just rookie stuff, so I'm not super concerned. I think as he gets stronger and as the jumper gets better, I think everything else should pop. Love the cutting, the random offensive rebounds. He just flies in. He's just a special athlete, so that's going to be fun. With Cam Whitmore, literally anything aside from scoring the basketball, I think would be a positive moving forward. That man could very much... He gets downhill with such force. He's incredibly fun in transition, which pops even more in Houston since they don't run as much. He will be his own transition opportunity. So, like, that portion's fun. I've loved the Jabari year. He's been really good defensively across multiple positions. And after just not making nearly enough shots last year, and that being a bit concerning, he is surely making shots this year. So that part's been fun. Like, I like the Houston young guys. Like, I do wonder... Yeah, just how much rope Jalen gets with the ball in his hands, especially under Ime, who he's very much, you just got to tell, like, okay, these guys are going to play hard. These guys are going to be in their spots defensively. This is who we want to roll with. Jalen's going to have to find his way within that. So I'm really curious to see what the second half of the year is going to look like. Any thoughts there? Or okay, we got the thumbs up from Steve. I'm going to take that. All right, this is going to come from Twitter, from Zay Wavy. Do the Magic have a good enough offense to make the playoffs, win the play in parentheses, win the play in or the sixth seed? And what would the offense have to look like for them to do it? I think for me, like, we're post trade deadline. Like, there are always going to be the obvious how much shooting does Orlando have concerns. And, like, unless they become the Otto Porter Jr. team, and that also opens the question of, okay, when is he playing? Because they got all these forward, versatile forwards and front court players. Like, I don't think that gets better from a personnel standpoint. I do generally think they space well. Teams just have a bunch of help points. So I think beyond the obvious hope, the guys that are supposed to shoot, shoot. Joe Ingles knocked down shots. Franz Wagner, who's played well heading to the All-Star break. If he gets back to normal from three, like, that should certainly help. Paolo, if he continues to gain comfort taking those threes and knocks those down, that would be helpful. Outside of that, they have to get more in transition. I understand the defense being their foundation. That is the best part of their team. They have been flirting around the top five in defensive rating all year long, and that's a testament to their personnel, how well they played, how well Jamal Mosley is coached, all that good stuff. But they have athletes. You have Paolo who can grab a board and go. Franz can grab a board and go. Wendell can at least grab a board and bring it past half court, and you can flow into stuff from there if you want to. Jalen Suggs can just be a cannonball, complimentary or derogatory. I would like to see them run more. Like, even if they're still going to be the selective transition team, I think they do need to run at a higher rate than they currently do. Like, right now, they are, in terms of points per possession, they're 22nd in transition in transition offense. They are 23rd in transition frequency.
Do we have anything off with them off stops?
Them off stops?
I can force some turnovers?
I can pull that very quickly. Sure can.
Because I feel like that's the bit with Orlando. Mm-hmm. And it may just be trying to control. But I feel like Fultz will push and go. Mm-hmm. I just wonder how much of the dynamic is we need to get stops. If we get stops, let's make sure we're trying to control the tempo that way to a degree. Mm-hmm. Like the reverse Lakers.
No, that makes sense. So again, as I said earlier, Orlando 22nd in points per possession in transition per cleaning the glass, 23rd in frequency. Off of steals, they are 10th in points per possession in transition, 18th in frequency. Off of live rebounds, so just grab a board, 26th in points per possession, they are 25th in frequency.
Okay, so kind of. It's basically steals or not. All right, continue with your transition magic thoughts. My fault.
Okay, no, that was it. I was just going to say, like, if they can find some easier opportunities there, push the needle a little bit more, I think that gets them out of the half court as often as they are. And you can kind of alleviate some of the, wow, they are helping off a bunch type situation that they run into. But I think that's going to be the easy thing. Because, again, there isn't anything they can do really personnel-wise to shift things in a major way. Like, that's going to be an off-season thing. But I think the transition stuff is going to be the lowest hanging fruit they have.
I think there's value to Orlando. I think they have some pretty clear, I guess you'd call, areas of opportunity that we know hurt them or could hurt them in this kind of context. Do they have enough scoring outside of Paolo and Franz? Do they have enough shooting? Can they generate enough shots? Can they put pressure on defenses to avoid just, hey, it's a switch, or hey, it's a drop? I do think there is value that they have a pretty clear hierarchy on offense. I think they're aware of who they are and what they do, and they have that identity and they believe in it. You know, having Franz and Paolo who can play, make, and score, having bigs who can screen and roll or space and pop, the growth of Jalen Suggs and some of the attacks he can do when he gets the ball off a kick, they aren't afraid to grind you later in the clock if need be and work to generate quality shots. I do think Paolo Banchero's playmaking has grown as far as being able to engage defenses, see help, make the right read, make the right play. Franz has been able to mix in the playmaking and grown in that area, so that's a plus. The one thing Orlando does do is they work to generate spacing in the half court. You know, a lot of people considering if you don't have great shooting, you don't have spacing. That's not always the way that it goes. They mm-hmm. work to clear wings. They go empty side, pick and roll. They cut to create movement, you know, on a second side. If you watch them, one side's doing one thing, the second side's doing another. And now we're going side to side, trying to find a way to find a gap. They can compete, but this is part of the journey for a team like this. We need these reps. How good is this defense in this context? How good is our offense? What are the flaws? Is it we play too slow? Is it really just the shooting? Is it team switch? They're going to have to find that part of it out. So do I think they can compete? Absolutely. But I'm not necessarily going to hold it against them and be like, well, they just didn't have enough shooting. So who thought they couldn't do it? No, I mean, like, that's just not the way I look at it. Because there's different ways to win games. Different teams can have success. If that defense plays lights out in a playoff context or a play-in context, they might look different and give themselves a shot. if they're in a play-in and they can't make shots, they might lose by a lot. That's part of the journey, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like people can't forget that portion of it when we're looking at these teams and how they develop and build. You know, I don't want to just stamp it as, hey, is their offense good enough? Maybe not.
What can they find within that?
Was the Tibbs Bulls offense ever good enough? Sorry, Tibbs. Grit and grind Grizzlies, literally, hey, big dog. If we ain't scoring, you ain't either.
Come down here in the mud with us.
So there's value in that. But I do think they can't compete. It's going to be based on matchups, though. Mm-hmm. It's going to be based on matchups. But their defense is going to give them a shot.
There you go. Which, very quickly, how much fun have you had watching Paolo and Franz play off of each other, particularly recently?
It's gotten a lot better. They're making quicker decisions. That's been the most fun part for me, to where one side, I don't have it. Here you go. You attack. Let's keep playing out of it. As opposed to pause, back up. Now I try and attack. Overexplore, that type of beat. I've liked that dynamic.
Got you. All right. Another Orlando question from Jake, who says,
Orlando Magic.
Okay. Anyway, what does Paolo Banchero need to average or achieve the rest of the season to make an all NBA team?
So here's the tricky part. And I like the question, Jake. I don't know if you're going to like my answer. Oh, I think the single toughest part for Paolo Banchero to make an All-NBA team is that the All-NBA team is positionless this year. Mm. And so he is going to be competing with a whole lot of folks with numbers and winning and impact, and it's just going to be difficult. He's averaging 23 points, 6.9 rebounds, 5.3 assists as we record this pod. I went ahead, put my bunny suit on, went down a quick little rabbit hole. Here's the list of players averaging 20 points, 6 rebounds, and 5 assists as of right now. Are you ready?
Yeah, what you got?
Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Scottie Barnes, Luka Doncic, Alperen Şengün, Julius Randle, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Nikola Jokic, Domantas Sabonis, Paolo Banchero.
So if I can count, that is 10 names just doing that.
Just that.
And the All-NBA teams are 15 spots total.
So it would be stiff competition even with just bigs or front court. But now you mix in the allotment of talent of guards that are playing well. And I think it just becomes more of a number game, less than he's not in the conversation. So what would he have to average? 26, 9, and 7 or something like that. With Orlando taking the sixth seed. That sounds wild, but.
Yeah, he would have to hoop. Like, I think, how to frame this? Just imagine air quotes next to the word help. But what helps Paolo in this case is that Randall's currently out. He may be eliminated by the games play thing. Embiid's already out. LeBron is at 49 games right now, and he's already been ruled out. Again, recording on Thursday, he's ruled out for the Warriors game happening later tonight. We don't know how long that absence is going to be. And so what will, quote unquote, help moving forward is if other guys miss games, and that shrinks the pool. But with just him in particular, like, the one thing that, you know, we talked about this when we were on with JJ, but like, the one thing that kind of helped me with some of the Paolo stuff was, like, I understand the context. The efficiency does hurt when compared to some of these other guys that he's in competition with. And like, on the
year, Steve, that efficiency, that man got to create everything, man. What you mean? How you want to be efficient operating in a phone booth? I'm quoting you. I'm giving your bars back to you. You.
Be a better free throw shooter. That ain't got nothing to do with the phone booth. That would help the.
Actually, you know what? I want to say something real quick to Magic fans, because they was mad about that Steph Curry hashtag block during the All-Star game. And I was like, dog, ain't Paolo like eighth in the league in free throw attempts? And he'd be missing those two. But I didn't want to say the second part.
But anyways, that's kind of tough.
He makes more free throws and stuff. It's a credit to him, honestly, because if you look at the drives per game of like the top 10 free throw attempts, Paolo's not as high as you would think, even though he drives the ball. And I was like, oh, I mean, he gets that line, boy.
He does get to the line. He's also just one of many victims in NBA history to where he's so strong that like contact that might move someone weaker than him just doesn't move him. And thus ref doesn't think it's a foul when it absolutely is. So like there's a bit of that baked into it too. But like Steve mentioned, the averages up top 23-7-5. It's a 54.9 true shooting percentage right now. League average is 58.3. But since the beginning of the year, 25-7-6, a 55.3 true shooting, which is about 3 points lower than league average in terms of true shooting. But the box score numbers are better. If he makes his free throws, 3-point percentage up a little bit. Do we get 28-7-6? 28-7-7 to close out the year? Like, I don't think that's far-fetched. Like, we had a stretch earlier in the year where it wasn't the highest volume, but Paolo's flirting with 40% from three. We've seen him have stretches of knocking down free throws at a high clip before. If it's just that portion of it, now you see more doubles as he gets comfortable with the pull-up. In particular, he gets more two on the ball that opens up more passing opportunities that helps open up some things for Orlando's offense. Like, if you get that plus winning, because I don't think the defensive foundation is going anywhere, that at least puts him higher up in the conversation. To Steve's point, like, it's still a deep pool. Even if you eliminate some of the injury guys, you're bringing the guards into the conversation. Like, that's still just going to be tough. But, yeah, 28-7-7. Like, I don't think that's out of the question over, like, a, you know, 18-20-game stretch. And then if the wins come along with it, hey, who's to say? Who's to say? But shout out to Paolo. Shout out to the Orlando Magic. And the song after they win games. Very catchy. Anyway, this is going to come from tweets by Tay. Is OKC ready for a deep run in the playoffs, or will the youth hold them back?
What's a deep run? What do you consider to be a deep run, Nikias?
Well, for me, when I hear deep run, I think conference finals. I don't think winning a round is deep. I think winning a round is successful, especially for a team with, you know, OKC very much building still. But if you, the wording deep playoff run, I think it's conference finals or finals.
Winning a playoff series is hard.
It is.
Winning a playoff series in the Western Conference is hard. Like, just as of today, right?
Mm-hmm.
OKC is the 2 seed, half game up on the Clippers, game and a half up on Denver. So if they have some sort of slippage, it could be, hey, here's Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, and Bradley Beal in the first round. But let's say they stay at 2, right? Your reward, as of right now, Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, Sacramento, and Sabonis and Fox and all that movement, LeBron James and Anthony Davis, or Stephen Curry and the Warriors?
Yeah, that seems like a lot of fun to deal with.
So, I struggled with this part of the question because I wouldn't be surprised by any of these teams making a conference finals run. That's how good the Western Conference is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Strip the seeds away. Like, obviously, we need them. But you strip them away, it's going to be hard. There's not a single team whose path I'm like, yep, that's going to be easy. So that's where in my mind I'm like, yes, they could absolutely make a deep run. I don't know if it would just simply be the youth and inexperience that gets them there. That could pop up in these moments. But they've done the work to sustain that over the season. And honestly, sometimes with these teams, you don't know what you don't know. That could be a positive. You know, it come out in nerves, but also, hey, we've been doing this all year long. We have a very specific style of play. We can impose that on teams. Drive, kick, cuts. Shea puts pressure on everybody. We can play our way. And now we execute defensively, not just with length and activity, but with a game plan. Or they could get hit with a game plan. And a team decides, okay, Shea, not you.
Not the box and Shea.
Or, you know, hey, let's try and take away this. Let's not guard this person. Let's try and make Giddy ineffective, Dort ineffective. Let's try and take away some of your lineup flexibility and your versatility and force you to try and do something else. Here's the thing about this OKC team. They have always found a way to respond. They're usually proactive with adjustments. And if you throw something at Mark Dagnall, look at the look in his eyes when a team throws something at him. I feel like he gets hyped when there's an adjustment to be made. And it's like, oh, yes, all right, let's go. Time to go. So it's part of the process either way. they're going to have to go through that playoff game plan experience and see what a team tries to throw at them. It's the one thing I've tried to monitor. I was wrong on OKC this year, but I am intrigued to see how are they going to respond to being in that scenario where it's not just surviving that one. Now it's okay. We've thrown a game plan at you. We see what you're doing. We have another adjustment behind that. So that little mini game is going to be fun. That playoff intensity, that kind of adversity. But this is just still to me about finding out how far this group can go and what do they need to add going forward. And we're going to find out. Is it the defense? Is it the shooting? Is it teams just sitting on drives in the playoffs and switching and competing at a higher level defensively that kind of takes that style of play from a, you know, A to a B? Like, do they get hit with like a Sacramento Kings from last year type counter where this is cool and all, but we're just not going to guard that person? Or that person is now going to have to do this, and we're going to find a way to navigate these actions. How do they adjust to that? So TLDL, they're ready, but also.
Gotcha.
Did I do that right? Did I do that acronym right? Too long didn't listen? I don't know. It's fine.
We'll work on it. We'll work on it. Leave your comments in the reviews. Anyway, to answer the question, like, I do think they're ready for a run. Like, I think Shea is just that good, first and foremost. So, like, yes, will the youth hold them back? I don't think the youth would hold them back. Like, I may just end up taking an L on that, and they just turn into, like, a 19 turnover per game team in the first round. They lose in five or something. I'm like, well, I guess so. But, like, early inclination, I don't think the youth will do them in. Like, I think if OKC loses in, like, round one or they bow out in round two, I think it's going to be the size and that showing up in the rebounding or the shooting falling off. I think it'll be one of those two things. Like, I don't think we get the abundance of Shea averaged 6.3 assists and 5.8 turnovers in this series. Like, I don't think we get that from him. I don't think we get jittery Jalen Williams. I think a team that beats the Thunder will be a team that takes 7, 8, 10, 12 more shots per game than them because they get blasted on the offensive glass. I don't think that's youth and a lack of experience. I think that is a personnel shortcoming, which to bounce off of Steve would be the, okay, we need to, what do we need to add moving forward with this group? This is, oh, we're switching more of the Shea Chet stuff. And where's that shooting coming from? Like, I don't think either of these young guys, any of these young guys are going to be like too scared of the moment or anything like that. And like, even with the Giddy as a help point, we're just not going to guard him. It's not like OKC hasn't been seeing this. Like, Mark Dagnall had a whole thing about it. I think it was like a post-practice interview where it's like, it's a testament, you know, teams are respecting us more. Like, they're trying this kind of stuff against us and throwing different looks at us because they know how good we are. Like, this is an opportunity for us to get better. So like, I don't even think that portion would be new. Now, naturally in a playoff setting, there could be even more nuance to what teams do and OKC would have to solve that if it comes. But yeah, like, I don't look at this team and be like, they ain't been there. They're gonna throw up late. This very much feels like, oh, nah, we're just bigger than y'all. Like, Steve brought up the Lakers. If that's just a size deal, that gets kind of hazy. If Domantas Sabonis averages 19, 17, and 7, that's just kind of tough if he's just hitting Chet in the chest. Chest Holmgren, I guess. But like, I don't think it'll be the youth specifically that holds them back if they don't make a run. Long story short.
One day I'm going to look up their record when teams get 10 or more shots than they do.
Okay.
A little quick. They're 3-2 when their opponent gets 20 plus offensive rebounds this year.
That's impressive.
We got to keep it moving.
I saw your eyes light up when I brought the rebounding. I was like, oh, he about to go down the rabbit hole, huh?
Yeah, man. Because look, man, I understand, but also, man, we can't just lock them into that. This is too good of a basketball team for me to be just hearing about rebounding all the darn time.
They are. You know, I'm a fan of the Thunder. I'm just saying, if we get to, if the 2-7 is Thunder Lakers and they big and they get to the line and they get offensive rebounds, like, I think that factors it. Like, that's just a, you know, style the fight type beat. Like, I feel like that's the thing that can get them in. We're playing y'all 4, 5, 6, 7 times. Obviously, hey, they're 2 in the West. Like, it hasn't hurt them wholesale. But, like, that could be something that, okay, we're in a series now. We can just poke at this.
Hey, you know what could hurt them more?
What's up?
That team getting buckets and not needing to get rebounds.
That's true. That's very true. You are not incorrect. But, you know, we shall see moving forward. Next, we're going to come from Mackie. Says, hey, fellas, thanks for dunking on us, which that's okay. That's one way to start it off. Cool. I have a question about the two-man game between Tyrese Halliburton and Pascal Siakam. I didn't go back and watch film or full numbers for this. Shout out to y'all. But just from the eye test, I don't think the two-man game between the two has been fully activated. Obviously, it's going to take some time to develop, but I felt in the last game before All-Star break, they started to make some strides. Whether traditional pick and roll or inverted, it felt like they were sort of filling out each other's gravity in a sense. It occurred to me that this might be the first time Tyrese has had a teammate that is regularly going to draw doubles, and I'm excited to see how that can be utilized to create a space for cutters, open up Siakam to pop out a little more than he had in Toronto, and overall just be the basis of pace or half-court offense. So anyway, I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts on the pairing, in particular that last game against Toronto before the break and going forward. Well, I had a lot of fun with this one. So I went down my own rabbit hole. It's like, okay, well, let me check out this Pacers-Raptors game, the Pascal Siakam revenge game, et cetera, et cetera. And so, like, looked at the inverted stuff first. I think Sex Spectrum had it, like, 3 with Tyrese screening for Pascal. And, like, they didn't get much out of that. It was, like, double drag with Tyrese as the first screener. And Kelly Olynyk and Emmanuel quickly just botched that. Naturally, Pascal was the pick and roll ball handler there. So I think Kelly was just trying to stick with Pascal, and Emmanuel quickly just following the general double draft rule. Like, oh, okay, we switched this first one. And so it was just 2 to the ball situation. Tyrese just got a shot out of it. But anyway, they didn't get much out of the inverted stuff. With the more traditional setup, with Pascal screening for Tyrese, that's where it got interesting. It was like early switching. And I was like, huh, which sent me down a separate rabbit hole, but whatever. It was early switching. Then we got some switching doubles. I was like, okay, this is cool. Then the second quarter hit, and now it's Jakob Poeltl guarding Pascal Siakam. And they started putting 2 on the ball against Tyrese. And that just opened up a world of things for Indiana. It's like, huh, well, there we go. And so then that turned into switching double. It was like, okay, cool. And so that game kind of sparked me because, like, I've watched the Pacers on my own. We've watched the Pacers during some watch parties and stuff. And so, like, just kind of eyeballing it, it's like, you know, it feels like that pairing is seeing more switches than I anticipated. And, like, that isn't inherently a bad thing because, as we talked about when the trade happened, one of the benefits is going to be if y'all do decide to switch this pick and roll with Tyrese, Pascal can punish smaller dudes in a way that, you know, Tyrese's other teammates haven't been able to do. It's, like, not inherently a bad thing. But this feels switch heavier than even I anticipated. And then there was also just the natural – the sample's probably going to be small here once I get into these actual numbers. Like, Pascal hasn't been there very long. Tyrese was out. And then Tyrese had the minutes restriction on top of that. So I was like, okay, so even with the numbers that I'll look up, like, I recognize it might not be what it's going to be by the end of the year. So, like, that part's fine. So we get to the numbers, and it is with Tyrese getting a screen from Pascal, 1.13 points per possession on 60 reps between the two. We got 60 in basically 10 games with those two playing together. That is not a lot. But to put the per possession number into context, like, that 1.13 number is essentially where Jokic and Murray is. And it's also where Dame and Giannis is, which is very funny considering the conversation about what that duo has looked like and even what some of the film has looked like there. But they have scored out of that if you're just results only. But just in terms of that number, they're in pretty darn good company in terms of efficiency. But again, volume isn't there. Missed games, mid-season trade, all the good stuff. So that should bulk up. But then I went back to the switch portion. And I was like, wait a minute, how often are they actually being switched? That particular pick and roll is being switched around 42% of the time, which is very high. And again, much higher than I anticipated. And then you look at, again, Jokic and Murray, same points per possession number or roughly. Like, it's under 10% that they're seeing switches. Dame and Giannis is under 20% that they're seeing switches. So, like, the fact that they're getting switches to that degree is interesting to me, and I want to see, like, how that part goes forward. And I think that's going to be part of, like, some of the early wonkiness with them building out their chemistry there, because I think we haven't seen as much of Pascal operating in the short role as you may anticipate because of that. And so I'm curious to see, like, do the screening angles change to kind of force that? if they are now more anticipating that this is going to be a switch, do we see some harder or quicker slips from Pascal? We know Tyrese can hit guys on the slip. He's one of the best passers in the league. So, like, does that adjustment come there? Do they just empty aside more? As I go back to the Toronto game that was asked about, and, like, late in that game, they mixed in some of the double drag stuff. But also, they just empty aside, and you get a Tyrese reject, and he gets downhill. You got a Pascal Siakam reject, and he got downhill for one late. So, like, I think it's coming along. I do think they're going to have to figure out the switch portion, like how they want to specifically attack that. But once they got switch and double, like they were able to play out of that relatively easily. Again, Tyrese not super bothered when he saw that. And I think in general, he's just a very quick processor. I did kind of chuckle as I just went through, like, you know, beyond the Toronto game, just looked at all those pick and rolls and just how often Miles Turner was also involved. It's like, this just feels like an ends to a mean to get to the Tyrese Miles Turner pick and roll again, particularly with their double drag setups. So it may just be I just want to see these two play together. And I think the minutes restriction should be done by now with Tyrese, if the All-Star game is any indication. So like we should just get like a free sample here moving forward post All-Star break. So I'll continue to monitor it, excuse me. But yeah, a lot more switches. I want to see how they play out of that. When we have seen the short roll flashes, when you do see Tyrese get two to the ball out of that setup, like Pascal has a runway to play with. And so that part has been fun. I think they're going to figure it out. But those are just some of my early thoughts on what it's looked like and why it's looked like that.
I was stuck on sample size. Great stuff, by the way. Well, so salute to you, sir. Thanks. It was sample size for me. It's something I've kept an eye on, but I don't think it's something they're going to lean on outside of the clutch going forward, or at least in certain scenarios. Like the thing that stuck out to me about Toronto, you mentioned a lot of the things they ended up navigating to. And then I was like, oh, Jakob Poeltl's guarding Pascal Siakam. That opens up Pascal in the short role. That's interesting. Or some of their, like, is there going to be more impactful for them to be in dribble handoffs together? Is it more impactful to have the ability where Tyrese starts to set, it's drive kick to Pascal, Pascal continues it, or you have a different play finisher? Like, what's the true value of those two together? And how do they lean into it with a little bit of a different team? As far as we have the pace, we have the tempo, we don't necessarily have Buddy anymore. So some of the actions and sets don't have the same zip to it or pop to it or impact. So we're trying to navigate that as well as, okay, we have these two we can use together, but we can also bounce them out in different units. So, you know, is it more important to have Pascal as a screener when he's out there with the bench? Do we lean to Pascal in different areas there? So it's more something I'm keeping an eye on than this is going to make or break what Indiana does. Because I think even if teams switch, we've seen Tyrese be comfortable with matchups and making quick decisions. So I want to see more of it before I really just stamp it as it ain't working.
And again, like just to small sample, like 1.13 points per possession is a really good number. So the fact that it's there while they're obviously working out stuff and haven't gotten a big sample yet, like that's something to build off of. And I'm glad you brought up like, you know, them post Buddy. Because that was also something that popped, particularly in the Toronto game, when they went to switch and double. The ball ended up finding the hands of Andrew Dimhard a lot. And I was like, well, that would make sense, considering where Dimhard is as a shooter. Good basketball player overall, naturally. But it's like, okay, like in some earlier setups, or in an ideal world, like if that's Buddy Hield in that corner, yeah, have fun trying to trap that as quickly as you do. Or if you're going to switch and double, that's got to come from somewhere else. Because you don't want the extra swing to end up finding his hands, because that's just going to be a bucket more often than not. So, like, they're also just going to have to parse through some lineup stuff. Like, even with Aaron Nesmith shooting as well as he is, like, he doesn't have the same gravity as Buddy. Like, he's been a help point with some of the pick and rolls between Tyrese and Pascal. So, I think the break's just going to be good for them. Just kind of recalibrate, get a healthy run, and then I think you'll see them play with more stuff with those two. But some encouraging signs. Again, a little surprised by how often they've seen switches. And that also made me think about, like, it's weird to say, like, how much of that is Tyrese's fault. And I say I use fault loosely because he has gotten so good that he garners. I don't think you can guard him with, like, traditional point guards as much as you might want to anymore. He's just running that guy in the screens. Your defense has to bend. He's hitting every pass in the book. It's kind of tough. Like, he's generally just seeing bigger wings and bigger matchups. And because he's seeing bigger wings and bigger matchups, it makes it a little bit easier to switch the Tyrese Pascal stuff because those defenders are more like-sized. And so again, like, not his fault, like he's doing something wrong, but like to that point, he's gotten so good, he's seeing different dudes. And it makes it easier to kind of, okay, let's just keep this in front and do something else. And then you add in Nembhard potentially being a help point or someone else based on the perimeter where you can help off of. It makes it easier to kind of corral that initial stuff. And Indiana has to play out of it more than they may want to. So that's something that they can build off of, though. So I'll be curious to see what that's going to look like. Next one going to come from JP, who says, has Scottie Barnes shown he has the handle or vision to be a primary creator? Or is the Emmanuel Quickly trade evidence that the Raptors think he needs a lead guard?
I mean, for me, I think the vision has to be, how do we establish something to where we have multiple people who can do multiple things? So for me, it's less, does Scottie have the handle and vision to be a primary creator? And more, can we build a team that is going to allow Scottie to do different things and be impactful in different ways? I think having Emmanuel Quickly helps that out. I think that's part of what cores are kind of moving towards going forward, to where, yes, this person could do this, but we also have this person who could do that, and they could play well together. We can move the ball side to side. We have multiple people who can make plays, and now it's not just Scottie in pick and roll. We can get Scottie in the post. We use Scottie as a screener. Scottie can start a play. Scottie can end a play. You want to end up having a scenario where you are able to tap into his versatility, and that enhances your team while also giving others the opportunity to shine. Where RJ Barrett can now look dangerous or make quicker decisions and dribble handoffs. IQ can be involved. So I don't necessarily think that. I think they actually help each other out to a degree, because now IQ doesn't have to be tasked with all of the lead guard responsibilities to a degree. Mm-hmm. You can score. You can get two on the ball. We're going to see how these reps go as far as you being able to make these reads and how defenses treat you. But now it's not just one on, it's not on one person. We can now have more of that movement that we've been looking for. So that, to me, is the largest thing.
Mm-hmm. I love that answer, because like my initial answer to the question when I was putting in the dot was yes, to be frank about it. But no, like I think about what you said earlier. You talk about Fred VanVleet and like what it looked like when he had Jakob Poeltl versus what he didn't. And I get to this question, I think about the inverse. I was like, do y'all remember like what some of the Dolphins looked like when Fred VanVleet was off the floor? And what the lack of a pull-up shooter did to the rest of the offense. Oh, we're just switching all of this now. That's neat. So like, no, that's less about Scottie can't do it and more, we need to, to Steve's point, we need to be able to unlock Scottie in multiple ways. I think having someone like Emmanuel Quickly who just adds a level of speed and punch to the offense, I think it helps. So even if you're leaning into Scottie, it's not, you're not going to rank 28th in pace because Scottie's just slow grinding into post-ups that he's good at, to be clear. But even that just gives you a different dynamic in the half court. And then playing off of each other, the pull-up shooting of Emmanuel Quickly in theory should help open up some short roll opportunities for Scottie if he has it going. Or at the very least, you're seeing drop versus a switch. And there are pockets for Scottie to play within. And he gets some catches in the middle of the floor. He can play off of that. Like, to the literal, does he have the vision? Does he have the handle and the vision? Like, the handle could be tighter, but ultimately, like, I don't think it's a problem area for him within this context. And I think he absolutely has the vision for it. Like, I don't think there's a pass that he can't hit. It's more so going to be how can he continue to grow as a scorer so you can see more of those two on the ball situations, see more doubles, see Carter help, and be able to activate the passing. But, like, to that point, like, I don't have questions about Scottie being able to see the floor and map things out. I think that he absolutely can just do that. Scoring gravity is going to be the big thing for him. And to that point, if you have someone else that can unlock him as a roller, there's more avenues for him to score. You got to send help from different places. That should unlock the passing even more. Like, it all works together. So short answer is yes, but in theory, they should complement each other. Next one's going to come from Dante from the 404 on Twitter. Also, Crimson Slims as the display name. I got a good chuckle out of that one. But anyway, a Hawks question. In play style, Jalen Johnson and Onyeka Okongwu together have so much versatility offensively and defensively. Plus, Sadiq Bey's theoretical shooting makes space for Capella. Will Atlanta shuffle the lineups to maximize the strengths of the front court? I think it is fair for me to take the Atlanta question first. In terms of maximizing the front court, I feel like this is what, year two, maybe year two and a half of, hey, when does Onyeka just take more of this from Clint? And when do they lean into it? Slash, hey, will Onyeka be a good enough interior defender slash rebounder to where they can really make the shift comfortably? Type beat. But even if you look at some of the numbers, With Trey, Jalen, and Yuck on the floor, they're a slight positive. With Trey, Jalen, and Clint on the floor, -7 net rating per PvP stats. Like, you can get some of the basic numbers, like, ah, there's room to make the center swap in particular. To the overarching point, like, they do have some interesting lineup combination they can go to. Like, one of the funnier ones, at least looking at some of this filtering, with Clint and Onyeka on the floor together, the Hawks have won those minutes. Which, actually, brief aside, I'll ask you a quick question. So, like, the Hawks do this thing to where it may be just opening possession of a game, opening possession of, like, a third quarter, wherever the case may be. They're just running an exit screen for Onyeka Okongwu. Are you a fan of them leaning into some of the three-point shooting with him?
Why not?
Okay. I just want to get the quick thoughts there. Like, I chuckle. You look at the three-point percentage for him, it's, you've raised the brow a little bit. But it is cool that they're at least asking him, hey, stretch a little bit. Let's see what you can do. And in a season like this where it's, I think it's safe to say the Hawks do not have title aspirations this year, why not fully lean into what can Onyeka do? Because I think eventually they're going to make a decision at center, and he's going to take that on. And so being able to fully explore that is cool. But I think there's room to explore post-All-Star break, honestly. Like, I think there's room for us to see. I would like to see more of the Trey, DeJounte, Sadiq Bey, Jalen Johnson, Onyeka lineup. Get some shooting on the floor. Get some athleticism on the floor. Get a little bit more scheme versatile. The results may not be there in terms of wins and losses, but at least see what that group looks like before you have to pay people. Or if you know, all the Trey rumblings are out there. So we'll see what happens there. But, like, I'm kind of here from them experimenting a little bit more in the front court. What say you, good sir?
So just anti-Clint right here?
Not really. It's less that and more pro. Let's get some Onyeka. I feel like the more consistent piece in this one is going to be Jalen. Like, he's firmly part of the court moving forward, I feel like.
Does it do anything to the defense, Nikias?
You're not going to like my answer, but it depends on which version of Clint you're getting. At full tilt, yes, it hurts the defense.
What do you mean? I've been telling you about Clint Capella for how many years now?
Man, listen. Don't do this to me. Clint was doing some important things for Atlanta. It's going a little south, but you know.
Well, real quick, I'm no numbers wordsmith, right?
Okay.
But Capella, Murray, Young, Sadiq Bey, Johnson, 120.7 defensive rating. Murray, Young, Okongwu, Bey, Johnson, 119.4 defensive rating. I'm not moved.
I'm not.
I'm not moved.
Well, that is a hashtag unfortunate. It does sound a little bit better with Onyeka is what I'm hearing, though.
I'm not moved. Until they're going to defend, I'm not moved. They got a ton of talent. They got potential. They got things that should work. I came on this very podcast and praised them for it. Until they can play defense consistently, we're copy and pasting, folks. I'm sorry.
I do not. Let me tell you something right now. I don't care. All right. Last question. Also a Twitter entry. Comes from It's Pop Not Soda 13, which, let's be honest here, that was very close to just deleting the question off principle. That is incorrect. We're not doing soda slander. Pop is a sound. Pop is an action. It is not a drink, but it's fine. Anyway.
Do you know what region of the country you just offended?
Yes, they will be all right.
Well, go ahead and scratch the Midwest out of here.
They'll be all right. All of my Chicago pals in particular, but absolutely, y'all wrong on that one. It's okay. Anyway, the question is, anything you looking for from the Pistons for the final stretch beyond play the kids and can they fit together? Rotations, roles, etc. Well,
Cade and Jaden. I know you tried to disqualify with the can they fit together. You need to make sure Cade and Jaden works. Everything needs to make sure that Cade and Jaden works. Can you get Jalen Duren to not do a fake dribble handoff challenge?
I love how much that bothers you.
Listen, Watch the Detroit Pistons. Watch them run delay action. Watch Jalen Duren drive. He's playing hard. He's playing hard. But hey, can you get his defense up to a different level? Yeah, how many lineups can we get to where Thompson's at the four? How does the shooting impact that? How much can we get Marcus Sasser up to a different level? Can we build a base defensively? Do we feel more comfortable what we're running offensively? Can we find something to where, okay, this works. We have a concept. Now we know what pieces we need to go get to build on that. But the number one thing is you need to make sure that Cade and Jaden can and will play together, and you build the lineups around that. It's the number one thing for me.
Okay. Using the qualifiers, the thing I'm looking forward to, will Mike Muscala remain a plus-minus guy? Because it's the funniest thing ever that the Pistons are bad and they are winning his minutes. That will always make me smile on the inside. Beyond that, though, Asar as a screener, what's that going to look like? You already hit on the lineup portion, how you can unlock him more at the four there. That's going to naturally lead to more Mike Muscala at the five for the spacing purposes, etc. Jaden Ivey with the ball in his hands, what can that do for Cade off ball? Not only taking pressure off of him, but I wish I could remember which Pistons account that I followed that tweeted it out, that Cade's shooting 39% on catch and shoot threes over a recent stretch. Or maybe it's the entire year. I should have just saved the tweet, put it in my notes so I could directly reference it. So my apologies if you're listening to the pod, at me. I will quote tweet and retweet, I promise. But, we talked about Cade shooting and the pull-up shooting in particular. We got to see where that's going to stabilize at, particularly within a better spacing context. Maybe you can get to those shots a little bit easier. But if he just flat out proves he can knock down spot up shots, I think that's valuable. And you can alter some of his usage there, like run him off some staggers for like actual shots versus here's some off ball movement just to make you move a little bit. Here's another K pick and roll. If you can legit design some off ball stuff for him to play off of, I think that'd be helpful. And, getting the ball more in Jaden Ivey's hands. He's been very fun, very good as of late. I want to see more of that second half of the year. I guess within those restrictions, that'll probably do it. You hit on the Jalen Duren part, so I won't hang there too long. We can cap it there. To close things out, some players that we're excited to watch post All-Star break. As I informed Steve of how long my list was, it's like, you go ahead and cook, big dog. So I am going to do my best. So you are welcome, or I apologize. So let's get into this list of players that I would like to watch I'm excited to watch post All-Star break. We just talked about the Hawks, but very excited to see what steps Jalen Johnson takes defensively for Atlanta. As he gets more consistent, particularly as a low man, I think that could help Atlanta's defense, that isn't very good right now. If he's able to nail that portion of it more consistently, he is violent at the rim, get some stops. Atlanta can run out and transition a little bit more, further juice that offense. Going to be tracking his possession there. Ben Simmons, just general health. I would like for him to play basketball, especially in light of all of this. But I would like to see him play basketball. And Nick Claxton, I am keeping an eye on the drives. 67 Nick Claxton drives this year. Per second spectrum, 1.19 points per possession on those drives. The handle feels tighter, and it's not just catch the ball at the free throw line, one dribble, and do something. Like, we've legit got some perimeter drives from Nick Claxton this year that's flown under the radar because the Nets are what the Nets have been this year and all that good stuff. But keeping an eye on the Nick Claxton drives in Charlotte, because, of course, there's going to be a Charlotte reference. Cody Martin, I want to see what his role looks like post All-Star break, since the Hornets is traded for a whole bunch of ball handlers and, like, quiet is kept. Charlotte's been asking Cody to run some offense, and the passes have been fun. Only 4.3 assists averaging 4.3 assists since becoming the full-time starter on January 20th. That's well above his career high. He's averaging a career high in assists on the season overall, and the potential assists is going to be naturally higher number there. But, like, watch the film on some of his passes. Like, I clipped some stuff and put it on Twitter. So that's like a minute and a half compilation of some makes and misses there. But some of the pocket passes, some of the jump passes, we got some darts to the court. Like, he's doing some fun stuff as a passer. So I want to see, like, how much more of that they ask him to do as LaMelo eventually gets healthy. Again, Misha's just there. Trey Mann getting more on-ball usage. They're furthering the palette for Brandon Miller, which, to that point, keeping an eye on Brandon Miller as a screener. Not the strongest guy, lanky fella, but I like some of the angles that I've seen with him. Particularly with him being used with Cody Martin, like, a lot of flat screens he's getting out of there. So want to keep track on how those two play off of each other. And Brandon Miller's just been really good. In Chicago, Ayo Dosunmu, career high in points this year, shooting nearly 42% from three. Steve, do you know what Ayo Dosunmu is shooting from three in the calendar year of 2024?
No.
50% on 4.1 attempts.
Oh, there it is.
4.1. Yeah, like it ain't fake volume. It's not high volume, but it ain't fake volume either. He's also not driving as much during this stretch. So I would like to see if he finds that balance. Like, in general, you want him to be aggressive. And so I'm glad he's taking more shots. But can he find that blend of the shooting and the drives? If you get that plus the defense, you have a really fun basketball player. So keeping an eye on Ayo. Evan Mobley, very much on jumper watch since he's returned. In the 9 games since his return, 7 of 25 of 2-point jumpers. 8 of 14 from 3, though. So we'll see where that normalizes. Do we get the post All-Star break stretch that we got from him last year in terms of the offensive aggression and how much of that's going to carry it over into the postseason? That should be cool. Keeping an eye on Daniel Gafford's defense and the short roll decision making in Dallas. The drives from Jonathan Kuminga, which since that Steve Kerr article dropped, I think on January 5th, that was after the January 4th loss to Denver. Jonathan Kuminga averaging 20.6 boards and 3 assists. Nearly 1.1 points per possession on any trip featuring a Jonathan Kuminga drive during that stretch. That number is ahead of Giannis, Dame, Jaylen Brown, Zion, Paolo, and a few other high leverage names. So keeping an eye on how aggressive and how effective Jonathan Kuminga will be in the second half of the year. My guy, Amir Coffey, will he continue to take and make enough threes to solidify himself as the closing fifth for the Clippers? Or do they make a buyout move? I guess we'll see on that front. Shooting 45% from three this year, but only on 2 attempts. And a lot of those shots are open. So that's where I'm keeping an eye more on the volume than the efficiency there, though naturally he will have to make enough shots. GG Jackson in Memphis, I just want to learn more about him. He seems very fun offensively, defensively. Don't really want to talk about it right now because we're talking about the exciting portion. But he's been fun, earned a deal, already looks like a steal for Memphis. I'm just excited to learn more about him second half of the year. We talked about DeLon Wright on the last pod. I want to see how impactful the defense is going to be. Just having him at the point of attack should be a whole lot of fun for Miami. The Dame Giannis chemistry and pick and roll, and the numbers are good. The fluidity of those two being used together could certainly use some work. So we will see post All-Star break, post Giannis don't watch film, post Dame doesn't have Giannis in his start and everyone actually being mad about that for whatever reason. Let's just see how it continues to develop on the court. Nikhil Alexander-Walker, guy I've shouted out on the pod for his defense. Like, he should be at least on the fringes of the all defense conversation. I don't think he makes the team. It's only 10 slots, a whole lot of bigs, etc. But the defense is fun. He's also shooting over 37% from three. Moderate volume, 3.9 attempts, almost 4 attempts. Keeping an eye on Jaden McDaniels. How quick will the decisions be made for him offensively? Where will the shot land? What the drive is going to look like? Do we get a similar post All-Star break bump that we got from last year in addition to the defense? Herb Jones in New Orleans, keep shooting and screening, big dog. Really love what we're seeing there. Gordon Hayward's fit. He's supposed to play later today, make the Thunder debut alongside Bismack Biyombo. So we're going to see how he slots in, what those lineups are going to look like, what his usage is going to be like. Also keeping an eye on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's defense. So I just don't get packed up again for highlighting the defense. The Orlando Magic as a concept. Buddy Hield's usage, that man's been flying all over the place, and the playmaking has been fun. Steve and I have talked about that before, but we'll continue to see how that builds out, especially if, I think we got the tweet from Ramona Shelburne. I said the Sixers are optimistic that Joel Embiid's going to come back this year, so if we do get the full complement in Philadelphia, what exactly is that going to look like, and what is Buddy Hield going to do for Philadelphia's full-strength offense overall? What else we got here? Bobo as a concept. Some fun bench minutes for Mr. Bull. Never left. We here. Duarte Reef shooting in his defense. Can he do that without fouling? That'd be nice. Very much a dunker spot positional battle for the ages. Keon Ellis versus Davion Mitchell, who solidifies himself as that backup guard. we know they can defend. What are you going to do on offense, buddy? So we'll keep an eye on that. The Kings are +5 in 379 minutes with Keon on the floor, -105 in 579 minutes with Davion on the floor. Keep an eye on that. Keon also shoots better from three, so we'll see. I literally have Wimby duh in my notes. I don't think I need to explain why I'm excited to watch Wimby in the second half of the year. Keeping track of Emmanuel Quickley inside the arc. Shooting has been fun. The drives and the finishing at the rim, not so much. 39.7% on twos, only 0.88 points per possession. on Trips featuring Emmanuel Quickly Drive since he's been in Toronto. That is not going to be good enough. So we'll see how that's able, how that bounces back. Taylor Hendricks has a concept in Utah. Excited to see as they've made more trades at the deadline and stuff. Going to see more younger guys play. Who is Taylor Hendricks? What does he do? How much am I going to enjoy him? Excited to learn more about Taylor Hendricks. And finally, Denny Avdija, who capped off, you know, heading into the All-Star break, just 43-15 against New Orleans. But talked about the drives on my timelines, driving more. He's stronger, dealing with contact better. The passing is still there. Taking shots from the perimeter with confidence. Keeping an eye on Denny. And hopefully Jordan Poole bounces back too. Like, this has been like a sad year for Jordan Poole. I just want him to be happy playing basketball and like some of the efficiency stuff to bounce back. There is my list. I am sorry for talking so much. Steve, any thoughts?
Well done, sir. Let me get to my list of what I'm excited to watch post All-Star break. You ready?
Yes. It's going to say basketball. It's
going to be the CJ McCollum and Abbott Elementary.
Huh. Okay. Well, got the thumbs up, the nod from Steve. I guess that concludes the dunker list. any closing thoughts before we get out of here?
No.
Okay. Well, I've done quite enough. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter, having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you have a League Pass subscription, you can watch basketball games live with us. Hop on stage with us, chop it up, talk some hoop, ask us some questions, vent about life stuff if you like. During games, we're breaking down film. During commercial breaks, we're looking at what's going on. If we get some fourth quarter or overtime nonsense, we got Steve telling us what happened, why it did or didn't work. And then throughout the week, if we're not watching basketball, we're watching virtual basketball. We had some 2K Sims over All-Star break. You can find those on my YouTube channel, since that's where the streams were going for. We're coming from. We have random TikTok Fridays or Mondays or Tuesdays or Thursdays or whichever is appropriate. So if you are a TikTok user and you see some funny videos, you want to share them with us, you have days like that where we just kind of chill. We do a little bit of everything. So link to the room should be hyperlinked in the podcast description. Click on that, enter your information to set up your profile. It's free, no shenanigans. If it isn't hyperlinked, copy and paste that link into your browser. Once again, it is free to set up your profile, no shenanigans. We are on JJ Reddit's YouTube channel every Tuesday. So if you would prefer to watch / listen to the pod on YouTube, subscribe to JJ Reddit's YouTube channel. A lot of good stuff going on there. And again, we are there every Tuesday. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.